Good morning. It's 9 minutes after 6 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, and I'm here today filling in for Joy Cardine for the rest of this week. This hour, the topic is discrimination, and more specifically, a form of discrimination that many people apparently feel is still acceptable. An article published in Time magazine in April outlined the issue in its headline, "The Obese Feel More Discrimination." A survey of about 1,000 people indicates that they feel more heavily discriminated against because of their weight, and more now than they did 10 years ago. Our guest this hour is Dr. Rebecca Poole, the Director of Research and Anti-Stigma Initiatives at the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University. We'll be discussing the survey, its findings, and its implications. And, of course, you are welcome to join the discussion. Are you overweight? Do you know somebody who is? And do you feel that there is discrimination, or just the perception of discrimination, on the part of people who are overweight? You can join in toll-free at 800-642-1234. If you're calling from the Madison area, you can use our local number. It's 263-1890, and email works too, and that address is talk@wpr.org. Dr. Poole, good morning. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thank you.
Good to have you along. First thing I want to bring up is the topic itself is not exactly new. I know there's been research done on this in the past, and I'm wondering if you could maybe give us a short tutorial on the history of some of the research into obesity and discrimination.
Sure. Well, there are now several decades of experimental and population-based studies examining weight bias and weight discrimination towards individuals who are overweight or obese. And what these findings tell us is that these individuals are very vulnerable to negative stereotypes, bias, and discrimination in multiple domains of living. So, for example, we know that they experience weight bias in employment settings, in healthcare facilities, in educational institutions, and even among interpersonal relationships with family and friends. We also know that negative attitudes and stereotypes begin very early in development. In fact, children as young as 3 years old begin to display these negative stereotypes, which then only worsen throughout childhood and into adulthood as well. So both children and adults are very vulnerable.
So a lot of the terms and so forth that I remember from elementary school and middle school really do carry on through life.
Absolutely. And the types of stereotypes that we see among kids are things like their overweight or obese peers are lazy, unintelligent, not desirable playmates. And these kinds of things just increase over time. So the types of stereotypes increase in both frequency and in severity.
I was interested. I was actually struck by sort of the breadth of this discrimination, this bias, and particularly, you mentioned some of the places it's found in employers and families and so forth, and healthcare professionals was the one that really jumped out at me.
Yeah, you know, in the past 10 years or so, there's been much more research on this, and I think what's really concerning is that a number of studies are showing that healthcare providers among various different specialty groups are self-reporting negative attitudes and stereotypes towards their obese patients, that they feel that their patients who are obese are lazy, undisciplined, lacking self-willpower, are dishonest, and a range of other negative stereotypes. And the question that we need to be asking is this having an impact on our quality of care? And certainly some recent studies are suggesting that it is, and that obese patients are now avoiding important preventative health care services because of these types of negative experiences of bias.
And this at a time when rates of obesity are on the rise.
Exactly. I mean, we're talking about a population that is vulnerable to a number of health consequences, and so it's very important for them to be getting optimal health care and high-quality care, and that this care may be compromised by stigma.
Now, what I'd like to do is maybe refer back to the original study, the one that spurred this whole hour today, and talk about some of the questions that you were trying to answer as you and your team went forth with the study.
Sure. Well, this was two studies, actually, where we examined a nationally representative sample of over 2,000 American adults. And we asked people about their experiences of discrimination as a result of things like race, gender, age, body weight, sexual orientation, etc. And we looked at different experiences of discrimination, both institutional forms of discrimination, like we would see in employment settings, things like not being hired for a job or denied a job promotion, as well as more interpersonal forms of discrimination, so being the targets of insults or threats or disrespect or negative comments. And what we found is that weight discrimination is very common in American society and occurs in many of these settings virtually as often as racial discrimination. And we also found that, in fact, among women, weight discrimination was actually more common than racial discrimination. We also wanted to see how has this changed over time. And so we examined trends of discrimination in all these different areas over a 10-year period from 1995 to 2005. And what we found is that weight discrimination significantly increased during this time by about 66% and is now right on par with the prevalence of racial discrimination. So this is really providing us with evidence that this is a compelling social problem that we need to be paying attention to.
We are talking about bias against the obese this hour with our guest, Dr. Rebecca Poole, the Director of Research and Anti-Stigma Initiatives at the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University. And we're talking about a study, a couple of studies actually, and the results of which partially were published in a recent Time magazine article. We'll be talking about the full study with Dr. Poole coming up after these short messages, but we'd like you to join in if you've got time. 800-642-1234 is the toll-free number that you can call if you've got an opinion on this. Have you been discriminated against because of your weight? Do you know somebody who has? Or is this just a case of perception? 263-1890 is the number that you can use if you're calling from the Madison area. Or you can always use email, and that address is talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 18 minutes past 6 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell. I'm filling in for Joy Cardine today. We're talking about discrimination, bias against the obese this hour with our guest, Dr. Rebecca Poole. She is the Director of Research and Anti-Stigma Initiatives at the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University. And we're talking about some of the research that she and some of her team have done on weight discrimination. And right before the break, we were talking about some of the findings of the latest round of studies. And Dr. Poole, one of the there were a couple of issues there that you brought up, and I think I'd like to focus on gender to begin things. And the study that some of the results that I have, women reported, it says, I think here on average, 10.3% of women reported daily or lifetime discrimination because of their weight or their height.
Right, and that's an average among all women, and actually that percentage increases significantly as women gain weight. So while it's about 10% on average, among obese women that increases to 20%, and among extremely obese women that increases to 45%. Now this isn't to say that men are not also vulnerable, but there are important gender differences. So for example, we found that women are approximately twice as likely as men to be reporting weight discrimination, and that this tends to affect women at lower levels of body weight than men. So for example, men tend to be at more serious risk for weight bias when their body mass index or their body weight increases at higher obesity levels, whereas women tend to begin experiencing a notable increase in weight discrimination at lower levels of obesity.
And what do you chalk that up to?
Well, I think we need to consider the ideals of female physical attractiveness that we have in our culture that are very stringent and strict for women. And it may be that if they depart from these ideals, they are penalized more heavily.
You're talking about the ideal where everyone's thin pretty much all the time, and everybody looks good all the time. And on women, that is more of a factor than it is on men, apparently.
It certainly seems that our societal ideals of body types are certainly extremely thin for women, and that continues to be the case.
Another issue you brought up before the break was the increase in this reporting of discrimination, and you said it's changed. It's increased by 66%, and that's just in the last 10 years.
In the last 10 years. And it's important to note that this increase is actually not a result of increasing obesity rates, because one might think, well, maybe this is just the fact that obesity has increased. And we actually controlled for that in our analyses and looked at the average body weight across all these issues. And what our results show is that more people are experiencing weight discrimination itself. And that's a very concerning statistic.
There are more things we could talk about, but I guess what are the implications of weight discrimination? I mean, people just feel bad, or is it more than that?
It's much more than that. There is now an accumulation of science documenting both psychological and physical health consequences of weight bias. So, for example, we know that for both children and adults who are stigmatized or victimized because of their weight, they are more vulnerable to depression, low self-esteem, poor body image, and even suicidal behaviors. We also know that people who are victimized in this way because of their weight oftentimes cope by eating more food or engaging in unhealthy eating behaviors, and what may also avoid physical activity, both of which may just serve to, you know, ultimately reinforce additional weight gain. So there really are a range of negative consequences that are very serious and that can really impair overall quality of life.
And one of the things we should point out, too, is that this study, the people are self-reporting. And what is the factor of that when, you know, you are trying to figure out how people are reacting to you? I'm trying to articulate the question here, and I'm having some trouble. But what is that perception versus reality?
That's a good question. You know, first of all, it's important to recognize that we asked about perceptions of many different forms of discrimination. So we also included race and gender and age and body weight. And traditionally, when we ask people about these experiences, we're kind of relying on their perceptions.
Mm-hmm.
However, there is also a lot of research to support our findings that don't rely on perceptions. So, for example, experimental research. And I'll give you an example of a study that looked at this. A number of studies have examined weight bias in employment settings in an experimental study where they will invite participants to come into the lab and they will randomly assign them to one of two conditions. And in both conditions, they're provided with a job resume to read over. And this is for a hypothetical job candidate. And in both conditions, these resumes are identical. So the credentials, the education, the training is identical. The one thing that changes in the conditions is that the job applicant is described as being obese in one condition and average weight in the other condition. And people are asked to provide their judgments and opinions about the individual. And what these studies consistently show time and time again is that the obese job applicants are rated much more negatively as being less likely to be hired. They recommend lower starting salary recommendations for them. They assign them many negative stereotypes. And so this is an example of a paradigm where we can establish cause and effect and to see that this discrimination is real. There are also a number of other kind of large population studies that have tracked people over time, sample sizes as much as 12,000 individuals, and have looked at things like how does obesity affect wages? And what this research has found is that there is a significant wage penalty for obese individuals, where obese women earn about 6% lower wages than thinner women for exactly the same work performed, and obese men earn about 3% less than thinner men for the same work performed. And what's important about these studies is that they control for a range of different factors that might account for the findings otherwise. So things like family size, race, health insurance, you know, a range of different things, so that we can confidently conclude that this is really a legitimate form of discrimination.
800-642-1234 is the toll-free number if you'd like to become part of the discussion. If you're calling from Madison, it is 263-1890. Let's go to Boscobel right now, and Kyle joins us this morning. Good morning, Kyle.
Morning, Gene.
You're on the air.
I guess my comment would be that obesity, in my eyes, is something akin to smoking. You know, it's a chosen lifestyle. And to complain about discrimination, it just doesn't make sense to me.
All right, Kyle, thanks for the comment. And Dr. Poole, is it a matter of choice?
I think that's a very important question. And we need to think very carefully about this issue and consider the scientific evidence addressing the causes of obesity. Body weight is a result of a very complex interaction of genetic, biological, and environmental factors. And certainly individual behavior and lifestyle choices is part of that, but it reflects only one piece of a much larger, more complex puzzle. And so the idea that people can simply choose whether or not to be obese really oversimplifies the notion, first, that significant weight loss can be sustained over time and actually doesn't really reflect the current state of science. And we know that really only a small percentage of people can reach that goal. What existing science tells us is that, you know, relatively small weight losses, for example, about 10% of a person's body weight, is sustainable over time, but that weight loss above that amount is much more difficult to maintain. Most people regain their weight. And this evidence has led to a much greater appreciation of the biological factors that really help regulate body weight, and has even prompted a number of expert medical panels like the National Institute of Health to underscore these contributions of biology to body weight. And so we need to think about this in a much more complex way. I think the message that we are given from society is exactly that, you know, body weight is a personal choice. If you just work hard enough, you can lose that weight. But unfortunately, it's not that simple.
Do you find that most people don't try to get beyond the surface? That surface level of, you know, trying to get into the complexity of it, that it is for, you know, many people, just an average person walking down the street, that it's not a very complicated topic.
You know, I think that is very common. I think, you know, there's a couple of factors that play into that. You know, we live in a culture where we have a $1 billion diet industry, and that diet industry is heavily perpetuated in the media. And the primary message of the diet industry is that if you just work hard enough, you can have the body that you want. We also live in a society where the idea of personal responsibility for health is a message that is heavily promoted. And because of these kinds of messages, many of us don't think about the more complex issues surrounding the causes of obesity. And what happens when we assume that an individual is to blame for his or her weight, we're much more likely to stigmatize that individual.
You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell in for Joy Cardine today. We had an email here, or actually a call, from Jean from Green Bay, who didn't want to be on the air, but she wanted to pass on an experience that she had recently. She said she was out shopping, and there was an overweight woman sitting next to a smoker, and Jean thought to herself that she'd rather be a smoker than obese. And that's an interesting way of looking at it, I guess, Dr. Poole.
You know, that we've heard many similar kinds of things like that before, and in fact, even some studies have looked at these kinds of things, where people say that they would rather, you know, lose a limb or trade several years of their life than be obese. And I think a lot of that has to do with just how terribly society treats individuals who are overweight or obese, and that many people would rather take on some other kind of challenge or obstacle than deal with the societal stigma of this issue.
And that really does speak to the depth of feeling on this.
That's exactly right.
800-642-1234 is the number you can call if you'd like to be part of the discussion. Let's go to Dawn in Beaver Dam real quickly. Dawn, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a nurse, and I see and treat a lot of people who are overweight. And my thoughts, as I was listening to the doctor talk about biological and DNA factors and things like that that add to obesity, are that oftentimes people don't take care of them, these certain conditions. There's a lot of people who would never become diabetic, type 2 diabetic, if they watched what they ate and exercised good eating habits. And so one condition feeds into another. You know, there are a lot of people who have congestive heart failure who, you know, if they exercised and you know, ate well, they wouldn't have a progression of their disease to the degree that they do.
Dawn, thanks for the call. And Dr. Poole, unfortunately, we have a break coming up, so I'll have to ask you to hold your response to that until after the news from NPR and Wisconsin
sure.
Public Radio.
Okay.
Dr. Rebecca Poole is our guest this hour, Director of Research and Anti-Stigma Initiatives at the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University. And we're talking about the issue of weight discrimination, and we'll be asking for your phone calls. First, though, we're going to be taking time out for a look at the news from Wisconsin Public Radio and NPR. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It's 25 minutes before 7 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell. I'm in today for Joy Cardine. This hour, we are talking about research, recently published research on weight discrimination. And essentially, the gist of it is that the obese feel as though they are more discriminated against. And we are talking about that topic. We'd like to hear from you, by the way. We have an open line at 800-642-1234. If you're calling from Madison, it is 263-1890. You can also check in with email, and that is talk@wpr.org. We're talking with Dr. Rebecca Poole this hour, the Director of Research and Anti-Stigma Initiatives at the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University. And she was one of the researchers involved in some of this research. Now, Dr. Poole, before the break, we heard from Dawn in Beaver Dam a nurse, and who basically says that there are a lot of folks who are overweight and they don't take care of themselves, and they wind up with other health complications as a result. She cited diabetes and congestive heart failure. And again, that is an attitude that we hear an awful lot of.
This brings up another important point, which is that, you know, obesity has really become a national public health issue. And to address this, we need to really look at what can we do in our society to help change the conditions that create obesity in the first place. So I think we need to think more broadly than personal responsibility, which is an approach that, frankly, is not working, but also really doesn't stand up to the huge societal systems that are helping to reinforce obesity. So, for example, we need to be thinking of ways to make big changes, like increasing access to affordable, healthy foods, providing opportunities for physical activity that currently are not there, promoting healthy work environments, and healthy school environments where it's easy to be healthy. I think, unfortunately, right now, it's much easier to be unhealthy in our current environment, and we need to make it so that the default is that it's easier to be healthy than unhealthy. I think that would help change a lot of the circumstances that we have right now.
Do you see any push in that direction? I mean, there are always ads about, being more healthy and it's easy to do this, but it never seems to quite happen.
Well, I think that we're starting to see a shift, and we're starting to see a change in public attitudes as well. And for example, I think people are now more interested in looking at things like, okay, let's look at childhood obesity and consider that they are heavily targeted by the media to eat unhealthy, affordable fast food. And the amount of marketing that goes to children through television and other means is really contributing to this problem. And certainly, policy polls are indicating that people are ready to see changes in that kind of thing taking place. So I think that people are essentially getting more ready than they have been in the past to make some of these major social changes.
Now, we've been focusing pretty much here on the United States, and I'm wondering if attitudes are different in other parts of the world.
Well, in countries like the United States that have more Western societies where we see a much stronger value of thinness in cultures and where individualism tends to be a more salient cultural value, we see the same attitude. So, for example, in Canada, in Britain, in Australia, the same kinds of weight bias experiences have been documented by a number of studies. However, in cultures where thinness is not valued to the same extent that it is here, and countries where individualism is not as central, there are not these kinds of attitudes to the same extent. So, for example, countries like India and Venezuela tend to have more positive attitudes than the United States.
Let's go back to the phones right now, and we have open lines. 800-642-1234 is that number. Let's go to Laura, and Laura is with us in Stevens Point. Good morning.
Good morning. I am obese. I am 5'2 in a size 16, and I have experienced discrimination. I attend a university, and there are students that actually cruise the university just to catcall to the heavier students. You know, I've been called cow and all sorts of things, and you know, I've heard the ground thundering mm-hmm. as I go past. I've also had a couple of professors, you know, just kind of sit next to me and go, you know, you could take up jogging. And I have gotten this way because I had a very, very active career. I was fought fire out west for a number of years, and I now have arthritis in my knees and in my back. And so I'm not able to do, you know, jogging and that mm-hmm. kind of thing. In fact, my orthopedist just says that I can either walk or I can swim. And for this area, swimming is out of the question unless I don't have a day job.
Right.
So I don't want to be this way. I actually eat a really good diet. I'm a vegetarian. And it's tough. I have a beautiful wardrobe, and I want to fit into it. And I've been struggling for so long, but I can't go out and jog. I can't go out and rollerblade. I have to be very careful about what I'm doing at this point because my skeletal system has broken down. And having that discrimination where people just assume that I'm lazy and I don't want to do anything is hurtful.
Now, Laura, at one point, it sounds as though you were smaller, and then because of some health issues, you've gotten larger. So you've sort of seen both sides of the coin.
I have, but I've never been on the side of the coin where I'm looking at people and going, God, are you lazy?
Mm-hmm.
If anything, I felt empathy for those people. I did wonder, you know, why they didn't go out and exercise, but, you know, I guess karma comes around and bites you.
All right. Well, thanks for the call, Laura, and we appreciate it. And Rebecca Poole, there you go. Sounds like somebody could have been right out of your study.
Yeah, I want to thank you for sharing that experience. And I think that this really raises a couple of issues. One, you know, she mentioned really being stigmatized in kind of a college-university setting. And unfortunately, this is something that happens all the time. And there are a number of studies documenting weight bias and stigmatization by educators towards their students. And unfortunately, I think that has a lot of negative ramifications. And the other thing that I think is important to recognize is something that she mentioned. And she said, you know, that I don't want to be this overweight. And I think, you know, when we look at a person who is overweight or obese, it's very important not to assume that they've chosen to be that way, that most people have struggled with their weight for a very long time. They have tried different diets. They have tried different treatment methods, and many of which just are not effective. We have not identified effective means of losing and maintaining significant weight loss with conventional treatment methods. And, you know, I think especially for healthcare providers, when obese patients are coming into their office, it's important to recognize that for the most part, these people have tried to lose weight repeatedly without success. And this is really so much less of an issue of trying hard as it is at finding effective ways to deal with this issue.
We've got an email here from Jim in New Berlin. The guest mentioned the genetic factors in obesity, and he asks, how does this explain the rapid growth in obesity numbers in the U.S., and should it reduce the demonizing of the snack food and soft drink industry as contributors?
Well, first of all, if we think about the past 30 or 40 years, which is really the time period where we've seen the increase in obesity, our genes have not really changed during that time. What has changed is our environment. Our environment has changed. And so a lot of times people in our field will refer to obesity as something where genes load the gun and environment pulls the trigger, meaning that all of us as humans have genetic susceptibility to become overweight if we are in the appropriate environment that will encourage that. Now, what's changed in the past, you know, several decades is an abundance of fast food. It's accessible, it's affordable, it's engineered to taste very good, and it's everywhere. And as a result, this kind of food environment makes it very easy to create conditions that lead to obesity. And certainly we need to be looking at fast food companies and their contribution to this issue.
I'm reminded of the movie Supersize Me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that brought that issue to home. And at the time, you know, the movie is sort of interesting and takes a good poke in the eye at the fast food industry and so on. But it sounds like there is a lot of depth to that.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, we need to be looking at specific environmental contributors to obesity, and that includes things like fast food, marketing, portion sizes, all of these things that have really become very central in our environment that did not exist several decades ago.
Now, in the scheme of things, you know, there are a lot of issues out here these days. And how important is this? You know, when you look at all the other problems that are facing society, obviously you think it's important because it's your life's work. But, you know, when you're at a gathering and you're talking to somebody and they ask you what you do, do you get kind of a sideways look sometimes?
You know, I think 5 years ago I certainly did. I think attitudes are changing, though, now. I think there is a much greater awareness of obesity and the social consequences that come with this problem. And whereas 5 years ago people were kind of thinking, well, you know, what is this issue all about? I think there's much more receptivity now. There's been much more discussion of it in the media. We receive hundreds of calls at our center from educators, healthcare providers, employers who recognize that this is an issue happening in their setting, and they want resources to that so that they can really combat this and change it. So I think that I feel like attitudes are shifting, and I think that that's a change in the right direction.
Weight discrimination is the topic this hour here on the Ideas Network, and we're talking with Dr. Rebecca Poole, the Director of Research and Anti-Stigma Initiatives at the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University. We'd like you to join in if you can. 800-642-1234 is the toll-free number. If you're calling from the Madison area, it is 263-1890, or email at talk@wpr.org. I'm Gene Purcell, and I'm in today for Joy Cardine. It's 12 minutes before 7 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network. Coming up after 7 o'clock, we'll be taking a look at the Republican race for president and the presumptive Republican presidential campaign of John McCain. That's up after 7 o'clock. For the rest of this hour, we are taking a look, a continuing look, at the issue of obesity and discrimination with Dr. Rebecca Poole. She is the Director of Research and Anti-Stigma Initiatives at the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University. And her research, part of her research, became a topic of a recent Time magazine article, and we're talking about that and some of the other implications of that. Let's go back to the phones right now, and John is with us from Peshtigo. Good morning, John.
Good morning. I just wanted to call in and share an observation in that I agree with a lot of what's being talked about. At the same time, I feel like people who struggle with their weight will take everything that the research is saying that supports how they're not in control of their situation, and they'll use that in order to continue with an unsuccessful struggle, and they will kind of downplay or ignore the aspects of it that they can do something about. And I do have empathy. I was obese for a number of years, and now I've been 10 years within my BMI. But for example, one of the last ladies who called, and you can hear her pain, and I'm quite sure she is discriminated against. She mentioned that, you know, about swimming around here. Well, you know, I think, was she from Point? You know, I believe the Y pool opens at 5:30 and sometimes goes to 9 at night. And I don't mean to pick on her personally, but that's the type of thing I hear over and over. There's always reasons why that it can't happen, instead of looking at how it can. And just having, you know, been through the struggle myself, it often, when I hear that kind of talk, it just what I hear actually, you know, is an excuse to continue in unhealthy habits. And I know that it's difficult. So that's my comment.
John, thanks for the call. And Rebecca Poole, how do people find that balance?
Well, I think, again, it's about really looking at personal responsibility and how that fits in with this puzzle. Certainly individual behavior is part of this picture, but we need to look at this at a kind of a much bigger, broader, more public health kind of perspective, which requires us to really think, what can we do as a society to make an environment where it is easier to be healthy? And I think something else that this gentleman just reminded me of before is, you know, sometimes I'm asked in various talks that I give, you know, maybe stigma is not such a bad thing because it'll motivate people to lose weight. I've heard that a number of times, and I think it kind of comes from that idea that, you know, if you say that this is discrimination and that, you know, personal responsibility is only part of the picture, then that gives people license to not do anything. And in fact, you know, what we find from the science is that this is absolutely not true, that people who are stigmatized, again, you know, oftentimes react and cope by eating more food, engaging in binge eating behaviors, maladaptive eating patterns, and avoidance of physical activity, often because they're very heavily stigmatized in settings where they are physically active. And so, you know, I think we really need to think about, instead of using shame and stigma, what are ways to really support positive health behavior changes?
And I have to ask, you know, when John was talking, I heard him sort of saying, well, some people will pick out certain elements of what you're saying and use it to sort of defend the fact that they're obese and it feels hopeless to them. Is this a problem? Is this an issue that people can always handle by themselves? Because I think a lot of people wind up trying to do just that.
Well, I think, as we were talking about before, only a very small percentage of people can actually achieve a goal of significant weight loss over time. You know, the science is just not supporting the effectiveness of long-term treatment methods for many people. But in terms of weight bias and discrimination, I think people are certainly left to cope with this on their own. There is very little support out there. And as a result, you know, that may increase the likelihood of people turning to some of these unhealthy coping strategies as a response to bias.
Let's go to Green Bay now, and Mary is with us. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning. I guess I would ask your guest how she could help me personally overcome, I guess, my own discrimination problems. I live with someone, a roommate, who is obese. I've lived with her for many years. I myself have a problem, I guess, with being discriminatory against her. And I can see from an employer's standpoint at times why employers would not hire a heavier person than a thinner person. And the reasons that I have personally would be, let's say we're doing a rummage sale and there are big boxes to be carried. She will purposely take the smaller boxes and let me take the bigger ones because in my head she's lazier or she can't do it. If the house is very warm in summer, I crank out those windows and get them going, get the airflow going, and she'd just rather flick the air conditioning button because it's just easier for her to do that. And so I have to admit, you know, that I have these feelings about heavy people, and I don't necessarily like it. I'm not proud of it, but I have them because I've witnessed those behaviors, and I guess I can see from an employer's standpoint, gee, do I pick the one who's got the energy and who's thin, or do I pick the one that's heavier and maybe just as qualified, but do you know what I'm saying? Help me to not be discriminatory when I've witnessed behaviors.
All right, we'll take a shot at that. Rebecca Poole, any advice?
Yeah, sure. I think that, first of all, we need to really challenge our assumptions and to look at BMI or body weight as an indication of these different things that she's witnessed in her roommate. For example, when we look at someone who's overweight, many overweight people are actually very fit, and the body mass index or body weight alone does not automatically inform us of a person's health. So, for example, there are many people who are not overweight, who are normal weight or thin, who demonstrate undesirable behaviors, whether it's laziness or eating unhealthy or et cetera. So I think, you know, first of all, there's that assumption that we need to challenge automatically. I think the second is to maybe have her look for other examples of overweight individuals who challenge these types of weight-based stereotypes. There are actually many people who are emerging in the literature and in the media right now, and in sports, in a number of different areas, who are, you know, by BMI standards, overweight or even obese, who are extremely successful, hardworking, ambitious, happy individuals. And so I think the more that we can kind of showcase these examples of people who challenge weight-based stereotypes, then we can stop assuming that the default is a person who is lazy.
Interesting question, though, from Mary, because, you know, not everybody always tries to think about why they might have these biases and then take the next step and try to do something about it.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm very impressed that she called, and I think that, you know, really the first step is exactly what she's doing, is saying, you know, what are my attitudes, and kind of thinking about personal assumptions about body weight. You know, do I automatically assume that a person who is obese has a certain intelligence or character or lifestyle, and really starting with that and challenging those personal assumptions about body weight and looking for examples that challenge that.
Let's go to Patrick now, and Patrick's in Milwaukee. Good morning.
Morning. A quick opinion and then a question. I can sympathize with the female caller that you just took. You know, whether I go to the fast food restaurant, which I rarely do, or I go to the grocery store, or in the place I work, all I see is heavy, overweight people eating all the wrong food. And it's hard to not generalize when you see that. And my question is, what percentage of obese people could actually be documented as having some kind of physical genetic defect that causes them to be overweight? Is it 10%, 20%, 50%? Do we have a solid number?
No, we don't have a solid number. I think it's such a complex condition, and there's a lot of debate about what percentage of this comes from genetics and the environment and biology. It's a very complex interaction. When we talk about, you know, very specific medical conditions like a thyroid medical condition or something like that causing obesity, that is a small percentage. But I think that we have to recognize that obesity in itself it comes out of this combination of genetic, environmental, and biological factors. In terms of what the gentleman mentioned before about, you know, seeing individuals who are obese eating all the wrong foods, I think it's also important for us to take a look at all the people who are also probably not overweight and eating those unhealthy foods as well. I mean, certainly we know that the population in our country who is eating these foods is not just overweight and obese individuals. I think it really spans the entire population, which is why we really need to focus on improving health and food and nutrition for people of all sizes, regardless of whether they're obese or not.
Now, as we look forward to the future, Rebecca Poole, where would you like to see this research go? I mean, obviously, it's going to have hopefully an impact in your work. But, you know, 10 years from now, are we going to be seeing some differences here?
I hope so. I think, you know, in order to really reduce this form of discrimination, we need major shifts in societal attitudes. And that means that we need to increase awareness and education of this issue. We need to change existing media portrayals of overweight and obese people, which really reinforce discrimination. And I think we also need to consider even legislative efforts to address this issue. You know, right now there is no protection at all for individuals who are obese and who have been discriminated against, for example, in the workplace, whereas there are sanctions in place for race, gender, age, a number of other characteristics. And I think that we need to find ways to protect this population who are very vulnerable to discrimination and its consequences.
Rebecca Poole, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Rebecca Poole is the Director of Research and Anti-Stigma Initiatives at the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity at Yale University, and we've been talking about the issue of weight discrimination. If you'd like a copy of the program, call the radio store and just ask. They'll be happy to set you up. Karen Prager produced this hour, and Michelle Koffel provided us with on-air production. I'm Gene Purcell, and I'm filling in for Joy Cardine this morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.